listening to 1 in 10 from National Children's Alliance. I'm Teresa Wiesar, your host. Join us as we engage in one-on-one conversations with the brightest minds in science, medicine, faith, communications, and the law. We'll discuss the path forward to solve the greatest challenge 1 in 10 of our children face, child abuse. Today's episode is The Hidden Cost of Resilience. The ability to bounce back from trauma is a good thing. We want children to be resilient. But increasingly, research is uncovering signs that all may not be well with the kids who look like they're doing just fine. I spoke to Dr. Ernestine Briggs King from Duke University School of Medicine about resilience and its hidden cost. How can we help kids and families cope with trauma? What factors put children at higher risk? And what does the latest research tell us about the long-term health issues that even the most resilient children may face? So Ernestine, I think when we talk about trauma, one of the issues that comes up, one of the ideas that comes up quickly in the conversation is the term resilience. And I think a lot of people have differing ideas about what that means. Can you tell me, can you describe to me, what does it mean when we talk about someone being resilient?
Sure. Resilience is the ability to recover or adapt following a traumatic event. So it could be child abuse, it could be neglect, it could be anything that's potentially traumatic. But it's the bouncing back part that I think many people forget. So resilience, in essence, is handling or coping with adversity in a way that fosters growth and strength. It's a dynamic process. It's not just, you know, this personality trait that you have that makes you resilient. It is the ability for you to muster up the strength to cope with whatever adversity comes your way and end up on the successful end of that stick. And so I think a lot of people get it confused with you know, this inborn, innate trait that may be personality driven, or other people talk about it in terms of just grit and determination. And it takes a little bit more than grit and determination to get onto the other side of bouncing back.
I think you raise a really good point because I've heard it described that way many times. You know, they're talking about someone's resilience as though, well, gee, either you're born with it or unfortunately you're going to suffer additionally because you're not. And I think the important point you're making here is it isn't that you have this innate personality trait that makes you more resilient. So can you talk to me a little bit about the factors that make someone better able to bounce back from adversity?
Yeah, there are a lot of factors that kind of really help people bounce back, but there are also strategies that can help people develop resilience. So like things like thinking positively, right? The more optimism and positivity you have with regard to a particular situation, the better off you're going to be in terms of the outcome. Creating connections, I think that's probably the most salient ingredient across all the research around resilience is having someone that you can connect to, that you can lean on in times of difficulty will really make a difference in the outcomes, not only for kids, but for adults. And so that's another big factor. Gosh, there's so many things that you could do. Practice gratitude, do mindfulness, share your talents, just even shifting your perspective. But then there are other things like in times of adversity, seeking support, learning about interventions that work, and doing anything in your life that will cultivate hope. All of those are just strategies that we know can foster and promote resilience over time.
You know, one of the things that you were describing in terms of building positivity, I think sometimes when people think about a traumatic event, especially, and in our context, child abuse, it's hard to think about how you might think about it with positivity. But I think you're using that word maybe to mean something slightly different, which is also to find meaning in what happened to you. Which
absolutely,
which I think we see with survivors all the time, this search for trying to find a way to take a terrible situation and make something come of that. That it sounds frivolous to say a silver lining, and I don't mean it in that way, but to find some way to take something bad and make something good out of it for someone else, whether that's preventing that from happening to someone else or something like that. Is that the sort of thing that you mean when you're describing this sort of positivity aspect of it?
Yeah, so it could be that. It could be finding meaning and or making meaning, right? So thinking about how you can contribute to someone else's well-being by sharing your story or thinking about how to help prevent whatever this thing was that happened to you, this traumatic thing. It can also be about like having a growth mindset, right? And the growth mindset says something like, for every opportunity, it's everything that happens to me, I have the opportunity to grow and learn from. And even when it's a trauma, there may be something that you can take from that, that you can either share with others, that you can use to change your worldview, use to reshape the way you think about life and about other people, about your community. You know, like a really good example is like Mothers Against Drunk Driving, right? So they saw this phenomenon. And they rallied together, and then they started creating awareness campaigns so that other people wouldn't have to suffer the same fate that they did in losing a child or a loved one due to alcohol. So it's kind of that same thing. It's like kind of mustering up the strength to do something different and make something out of your situation. That's way different than just thinking about it as a traumatic event and that's it. And there's nothing else beyond that. And that I'm doomed and I'm gloom, you know, the doom and gloom that comes beyond that. So really kind of switching it up and making meaning in a really powerful way.
One of the things that I was struck by and thinking about that as you were talking is it sounds as though in many ways that the inner work or resilience, because there's a piece of it that's, you know, inner work we have to do. And then there's this piece of it, which I want to talk about more, which has to do with these connections and family and community. But the inner work is sort of a discipline. It's like exercising a muscle, it sounds like.
In some ways, it is like exercising a muscle, because the more things, strategies that you use to promote resilience, the more resilient you can become. That's the beauty of resilience, right? It's not just like this finite thing. It is, if you think about it, an ongoing way of coping with the world and all the challenges that come with the world. And the more you use that muscle, the stronger you become, the more resilient you become. And so, yeah, I like that as an analogy or a metaphor for thinking about resilience.
So when we also think about resilience, you know, there's this part of it that's about strategies that we can teach children to employ and that we can employ ourselves as adults. And, you know, we can teach caregivers to employ when they're dealing with the kinds of issues that arise in abuse cases. But there's also this part you were describing around connection with people. And I think one of the most insidious parts of child abuse, especially child sexual abuse, is that often families and victims feel such stigma that this has happened to them that in some ways it can be a disruptor to that connection that they might otherwise even have. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, when you're thinking about your own clinical work and you're talking with families about the importance of connection, what can we do to help families plug back into those support systems that may have felt disrupted by the abuse itself? Or the discovery of the abuse.
Yeah. So usually what I see at a couple of things. One is many times families where there's victimization, abuse, or neglect, there's also lots of social isolation. And so kind of helping them to rebuild some of those connections. And, you know, part of that is like learning to trust people again, learning how to feel safe. And it's not just an automatic thing. It's something that takes time. But with work, you can do that. The other thing that I see is kind of like what Dr. Pinus talks about in terms of a violation of the contract. Other researchers have talked about it in terms of a betrayal. But sometimes when we experience maltreatment or other things along those lines, it's by people that are supposed to be taking care of us. And it's really hard to make sense of that and understand why it is that someone who is entrusted with our care would hurt us. And so some of that reparation is around repairing the relationship, shifting the thoughts about why it is things happen, maybe even addressing feelings of guilt or shame related to the abuse. But all of that is part of a bigger picture of kind of rebuilding, re-strengthening, not only the way you see yourself, but the way you see other people, the way you see community and society at large. And so a lot of the interventions for trauma and sexual abuse really have that piece around creating opportunities for positive support and then reshaping your thoughts around what happened to you, your experiences, and processing it in a way that it not only diminishes the impact of the stress, but it may create opportunities for you to do that creation of meaning that we talked about earlier.
One of the things that I've been thinking about with kids that we work with is how, you know, some kids come to this place with a muscle to be exercised. That seems to me it's somewhat different in that, you know, all people face adversity of one kind or another. And when we're talking about childhood adversity and the ACEs, you know, many, many people face at least one of those by the time they're 18. But there are things that seem to compound that adversity. And it could be things in a family or that someone experiences, like racism or homophobia or sexism or other kinds of things like that. Can you talk a little bit about the way in which someone's sort of milieu, their environment as a whole, can contribute both to the adversity that they experience and also what role that plays in their ability to be resilient?
Yeah, so it's interesting because you know, some of the same things that increase the likelihood that you're experiencing trauma or any of those ACEs, like poverty, you mentioned historical traumas, maybe even racism, may increase your likelihood. So maybe, you know, living in a community where there is limited resources to get basic needs met, whether it is kind of the disproportionalities or disparities that we think about within the child welfare system and who gets selected, who gets, you know, pursued as a case and who doesn't, and all the decision points that kind of go through that trajectory, or how kids are perceived in terms of their reactions to their trauma. So we often talk about, for many Black and brown kids, their responses may be picked up by other systems in a negative way. So maybe they may be involved with juvenile justice because they were aggressive after abuse, or in the educational system, you know, getting more suspensions or, you know, expulsion problems because of their behavior that may be related to their trauma. So really understanding, I think, the role, the structural role of racism is an important thing as we start to understand resilience. But those kids are also the ones that are also more likely to experience more traumas. And so it's an interesting phenomena that we're seeing that even when kids do well, and in spite of all those chronic adversities, whether it's racism or homophobia or any of the isms that you can think of, chronic poverty, chronic exposure to trauma, we're starting to notice something interesting about those kids that are even resilient in those cases where they seem to beat the odds, they seem to be successful, they're able to regulate their behavior, they're able to address a myriad of things. And there's some interesting research by a colleague named Jean Brody, who's out of Georgia, who's looking at that and looking at all of those factors, particularly for kids in the Deep South, and finding that these kids are like amazingly resilient, but that there's also some cost to them in being resilient in terms of their overall physical health. And so there's a lot that we still have to learn about the mechanisms of resilience and how, you know, who survives, who doesn't, who ends up successful, who doesn't, which spheres of life do you become resilient, and which do you kind of struggle a bit? At what time, you know, do you do it right away, initially, after whatever exposures you've been encountering? Or are you a late bloomer? Like, does it take you a minute to get it together and then emerge out on the other end successful? So there's still a lot we're learning about resilience, even after 30, 40 years of studying it. That may be important for us to continue to do as research moves forward.
One of the things, I was so fascinated by the piece of research that you did pass on to me about the hidden cost of resilience, and I want to unpack that a little bit for our listeners. So that piece of research really was looking at those kids that I think many people would say, you know, doing so well, you know, some traumatic or adverse event has happened, they're functioning well at school, they seem to be functioning well at home, they're functioning well in the community, and yet... When this research, well, I don't want to be the one who unveils the ending to the research. So you tell me. I just found it fascinating. What were the findings about those kids?
So those kids actually did well in all of those areas of functioning, but unfortunately, what they were finding were a bunch of health-related problems in those kids, right? So they were at increased risk for obesity, heart disease, and a myriad of health concerns. And so they talk about it, the resilience, as being, you know, they've made it and they were successful in all the other domains, and yet somehow the trauma, the ACEs, the things that they've been exposed to have gotten under their skin, so to speak, and caused a myriad of physical illnesses. And so just when you thought they were over the hump and through the woods, they are going to have a number of experience with their physical health that they'll have to contend with. And that's kind of really consistent with some of the ACEs literature around cancer and heart disease, around, in some cases, early death because of the trauma and the ongoing exposure to the stress hormones in their bodies. So it was really interesting research to find. I would encourage your researchers to look up Jean Brody's research and maybe share that with them.
I think I've personally found it both really interesting and really sobering, because I think often in our work in children's advocacy centers especially, you know, we often are focusing on kids who you know, have clear trauma symptoms, and or a lot of acting out behavior, right? I mean, this may drive kids into counseling or their parents into an intervention in a way that other kinds of things don't. But now I think, you know, what are the implications for our work if we know that there are going to be some children who are going to present at the time of interview who may not have trauma symptoms, and yet they could carry increased health risk long term?
Yeah. So, you know, I think it points in two directions. One, we got to really focus on prevention, right? So we got to stop the bad things from happening and really kind of mobilize support so that kids have safe and healthy, nurturing environments in which to grow. And that to the degree that we can minimize and or prevent abuse and trauma, then that's going to be our first round of defense for creating healthy kids and families and communities. The other thing it points to is that knowing this will allow us to do more on the front end with regard to physical health screening and thinking a little bit more. I think the field is really kind of on the edge of trying to figure out how to really integrate physical and mental health. I mean, it's no surprise that those two things are related, but we haven't mastered how to really do that. And I think those findings really talk about not just the mental health implications, but the physical health implications. And as we screen and look for kids that may be at risk for trauma and abuse, that we also think about the physical elements that may be kind of festering in the background and strategies to remediate them.
I think you raise a really good point, and this comes to mind especially because in the CAC setting, we're really lucky in that we do have both mental health professionals and medical professionals available as a part of that response. But it's also true that I think in many communities, those responses are fairly siloed, meaning that they may exchange some information or not, as the case may be, but they may exchange some information. But I'm not sure that there's a comprehensive treatment plan that really looks at both of those elements equally. You know, often when we're doing the medical exam, even though it's a head-to-toe exam, we're expecting, you know, we're evaluating certainly forensically, but we're also expecting things like, you know, often things pop up like, oh, this person has a heart murmur, or, oh, there are dental caries or whatever. I don't know that we're always thinking in the direction of this is a child who could, because of the stress hormones, they could develop diabetes, they could develop a heart problem at a very young age. They could develop high blood pressure at a very young age. And so that we're really tracking that in an ongoing way in the way that we're assessing and tracking things on the mental health end. So it does have some significant implications for our practice, I think.
I really do think so. And I think CACs are well poised to be kind of the leaders in reshaping how we do that, right? Like, if a kid is coming in for a forensic exam due to suspected sexual abuse, for example, may there be some other things that they might want to screen for while they're doing their physical examination for kids? And I know we still have some ways to go with the research and really unpacking what are we looking for? Are we looking for elevated cortisol levels? What are we looking for over time that would give us some of those clues? But I think there may be some of the work in more of the biological aspects of trauma that are emerging. We see this in the brain research that's coming out. We're learning more and more about that each day. So I think in time we'll be better able to screen or think about ways in which to screen and or look for some of those things, maybe so that we can nip them in the bud early. seeing kids that are overweight and creating interventions to address the obesity issues might be one way to do that, or watching them or instructing them to watch their blood pressure, or getting treatments earlier on versus waiting until it's a significant problem that can't be reversed. So thinking about that, thinking about things like nutrition in a different way might be another way that we can start to intervene and think about how do we really foster healthy development, thinking about the whole child and not just their mental health or their physical health, but the whole child altogether.
Ernestine, when you're thinking about sitting down with a caregiver and talking about ways that they can support their child and knowing that issues around obesity especially can be sensitive, how would you go about describing what you're trying to support here or what you're trying, could be even what you're trying to avoid here, in a way that's supportive and caring, but at the same time doesn't reinforce what I think does happen with a lot of kids, and that is that food becomes comfort, right? And so you have kids who are sort of eating their feelings, so to speak, and parents who may feel that's the only way they can comfort their child. How do you talk to caregivers about that?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting that that might be an easier sell than some of the mental health treatments that we do, right? So, for example, you know, really kind of talking about their health and wellness, and I think many families are more open to understand the ramifications of trauma in terms of their health consequences, more so than in their mental health consequences. So I think that might be an easier sell in terms of helping them think about kind of, you know, not only that there's a pill for that, but there's something that you can do to prevent diabetes. Here are the things that we know work: exercise, eating healthy foods, and eating, you know, the rainbow, right? So, you know, having good veggies and all kinds of things in there. And I think parents can hear that as well as thinking about the mental health pieces in a way. So usually when we do the mental health pieces, we may say a metaphor, right? So, you know, trauma is like this wound, you know, and if you don't treat the wound, what happens? It may get infected, it may spread, it may turn into this nasty, ugly thing that you don't want to do. So our interventions are like cleaning out the wound and putting on a salve or something that may help it heal. And over time, that wound will go away because we've attended to it. And so much like their health or their mental health, we have to give them the tools to help them and the skills to help them really attend to it in a way that is not only culturally sensitive, but developmentally appropriate, and most importantly, effective, right? So we want families to do what works in ways that will really kind of shift how they're feeling, what they're experiencing, so that they can continue to grow and be healthy. And so I think whatever we would do, it would be in that same kind of vein of thinking about strategies to really make their family stronger. Because at the end of the day, that's what most caregivers want. They want healthy kids. They want their kids to do better than they have and be better. And so if we can engage them in that kind of dialogue, I think we can be successful in reshaping their lives.
And it seems like, I mean, one of the things I was thinking as you were talking is it's a very hopeful conversation, actually, because I think people feel, you know, most hopeful when they believe that there's something that they themselves can do that's going to strengthen their families, help their child, all of those kinds of things. And I was thinking about another piece of research that you had shared with me that sort of ties into this, which it was really looking at the issue of racism specifically and how that impacts kids and families and the role of caregivers in buffering against that family support piece. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Because I just thought it was a wonderful piece of research, and also, you know, speaking of hopeful, incredibly hopeful.
Yeah. So, you know, the one message that I hope your listeners get out of this podcast is, if trauma happens, that's not the end of the story. It is not that you are broken in any way, or that your life is destroyed. That there is always, always something that you can do to make things better. And, you know, just a little bit of hope, just a little bit, goes a really, really long way in recharting the course of trauma. And so we definitely want to be hopeful. We want to be optimistic about the outcomes, and the fact that people change, situations change, and those could be good things. So the research that I think you're referring to is really looking at how we can use our natural support systems within many cultural contexts, whether it be African American or Latino or even Native American families, and that sense of family to really kind of move forward and heal. And so a lot of the research around resilience is about bolstering the support around the individual and creating context in which they can have opportunities to grow. And so I think some of that just naturally happens in the cultural context of many families. And so really kind of resetting that course if it's off kilter, or allowing, you know, the natural kin network and all the people in the community to really wrap around that kid and family and really help them move in different directions.
You know, Ernestine, I'm just thinking about this, that one of the things it sheds such a light on is that in many cultural contexts, there's this pre-existing, without any of our help, without the help of professionals, there's a pre-existing support system that exists that's very powerful and can be really leveraged for a particular mm-hmm. child's benefit when they've suffered an adverse experience. And we should be thoughtful about thinking about it in that way. You know, I think sometimes when a traumatic event happens, we immediately kind of go into a deficit mindset about
right.
the bad thing that happened, all the bad things that may be happening within the system that's responding to them. We may not really be also focusing in a strengths-based way on the fact that there are these other support systems that may be very powerfully positive on behalf of that child.
Yeah. So it could be things like their spiritual or religious beliefs. It could be things like having a grandma or a set of elders who just kind of reach out and take that child under their wing and mentor them. There's just so much positivity that happens in many families. And so I think it reminds us to think about the strengths of families that they come in with, and how do we leverage those strengths to really foster resilience and recovery and healing.
So this is a subject that we could explore much longer than we have today to talk. I'm just wondering, for folks who might want more information about resilience, where's the best place to find that?
Gosh, there's so much good stuff out on resilience. Probably one of my favorite writers on this topic is a researcher and colleague at the University of Minnesota, Ann Mastin, who's written extensively about the topic of resilience. Her book, Ordinary Magic, really talks about, you know, almost the magic of resilience. Like, it looks like it's pretty easy stuff. And just by, you know, mustering some support, or changing the way you think about it, or having, you know, self-confidence and confidence in who you are, all of those things put together can help you cope effectively with adversity. And so she talks about all the protective factors and other strategies that not only foster resilience, but kind of what we're learning in terms of mental health outcomes, and then how we can use that to not only shape the lives of individuals and their families, but communities in the larger societies. And thinking about some of our systems, whether it be child welfare, juvenile justice, the school system, and really kind of creating a space where we foster resilience rather than squash it. And so she's one of my favorite writers on that topic. I grew up in a time where I learned about people like Norman Garmezy, who was also at Minnesota, and Sir Michael Rutter, who were kind of like the pioneers, and Emmy Warner, who had these pioneering studies of resilience and really understanding all the cultural aspects of it. The NCTSN website has a lot of good stuff on resilience. There's webinars and fact sheets and all kinds of things for caregivers, for providers, for people that are just interested in the topic. And so I would point you to www.nctsn.org for more information. And when in doubt, you could just Google it. I'm sure there's probably something really good that comes up on resilience, whether it be, strategies to improve your resilience or some of the latest research on what we're finding in this area.
Even Sesame Street. I saw some little episodes on there that I thought touched on, which I thought was fabulous.
So. Oh my goodness, I don't know if you've seen it, but the latest one is about one of the characters whose family is dealing with substance use, and they just do a nice way, just do it in such a kid-friendly and developmentally appropriate way. But what they're actually doing for that young lady is going to foster her resilience. So even Sesame Street.
It's great that there are all these resources for kids and for all of us. Well, thank you so much for having this conversation with us. And we'll look forward to talking to you more about this in the future. Thanks, Ernestine.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 1 in 10. We hope you'll tune in for our next episode when we'll talk to Yasmin Vafa of Rights for Girls about how some legislation to decriminalize adult prostitution could end up hurting children. For more information about National Children's Alliance and the work of children's advocacy centers, visit our website at www.nationalchildrensalliance.org.